and former CEO of Sears Roebuck and Company. In all, Rosenwald funded 5,300 schools throughout the South from 1913 to 1932, and now filmmaker Aviva Kempner has produced a documentary as a way of shedding light on this major but little-known contributor to the advancement of African-American life in America. Her film, Rosenwald, the remarkable story of a Jewish partnership with African-American communities, opened this weekend for a two-week run at the Regal Ballantyne Village Stadium 5 Cinemas. And Aviva Kempner joins us this morning by phone from Washington. Good morning. Thank you for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Betty Edwards Murchison attended a Rosenwald school in Wake Forest, and although she attended other schools following integration in 1971, her grounding was in segregated schools. And she's also been actively working to revitalize the remaining Rosenwald schools around the state, and she joins us from studios at WUNC in Durham. Thank you for being here, too.
Thank you.
And with us in our studio here in Charlotte is historian Dan Morrill, who happens to be the director of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Historic Landmarks Commission. Good to see you again.
Always.
Always good to see you.
Yep.
Aviva, let me start with you, because let me lay some groundwork here about Julius Rosenwald. You've called him the greatest philanthropist you've never heard of. And given the incredible impact that he had on the lives of African Americans in the early 20th century, why is his contribution relatively unknown today?
Well, I think it's a combination of factors. First of all, he was born in 1862, so, you know, it's over 150 years ago. Second of all, he operated out of Chicago. He was a man who bought into Sears with his brother-in-law, made millions of dollars, was very motivated by his rabbi and this tenet in Judaism called Tikkun Olam, repairing the world. And he had then read Up from Slavery and was so impressed and moved by the story of Booker T. Washington, mm-hmm. both in fact of, you know, having been a freed slave, getting education, and started Tuskegee. He got very involved in Tuskegee. And when he turned 50, he decided to give a lot of money away, sort of the philosophy of give while you live. And it was at that point he was already on the board of the Tuskegee University that Booker T. Washington said to him, well, you know, we have horrible schools for young people, you know, primary schools. Can you help build some schools, near Tuskegee? Mm-hmm. So he did, and that was five of them, and they were so successful.
Well, there's a lot in there. Let's unpack this. Let's back up and slow down a little bit, because there's a lot of stuff in there. First of all, he was the son of an immigrant who became a peddler.
Who came here with $20 in his pocket and who went from, you know, the West Virginia, it was in Virginia, the Winchester Trail, and then moved up, married into the family that sent him out to be a peddler. And he essentially married the boss's wife. And then they settled in Springfield, which is very significant because it turns out that Julius Rosenwald's uncles clothed Lincoln. One of them was close to Lincoln, accompanied his body back. And Lincoln was already dead when Julius Rosenwald was born. But the whole aura of Lincoln and what he had done is something that Julius Rosenwald grew up with.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because he grew up across the street from the house Abraham Lincoln occupied before becoming president in Springfield, Illinois. And I was going to ask about whether that proximity to history played a role. Obviously, it did.
Obviously. I mean, when the Lincoln Memorial was built in Springfield years after he died, Julius Rosenwald actually sold programs there. And you know, in these programs that were talking about the legacy of Rosenwald, mm-hmm. and he grew up hearing of it. So it was definitely, you know, a very early influence to his consciousness of what leadership was or what you needed to do.
Your film points out a parallel between the Jewish pogroms in Eastern Europe and Russia and the kind of terror and oppression of Southern blacks perpetrated by the Ku Klux Klan. Is that how Julius Rosenwald saw it as well? Did that realization that there was this parallel come fully blown into his mind at some point, or did it grow on him gradually over time?
No. After he bought into Sears and it became very, very successful, he was very involved in the Jewish community, both in Chicago and in the nation. And it was at that point that they tried to respond to what happened with the pogroms in Eastern Europe. And after reading Up from Slavery and becoming involved in civil rights issues, like building, helping to build Y's for African-Americans fleeing the Jim Crow South, he definitely wrote about it and talked about the parallels. Wow. And we also have Maya Angelou in the film, someone who I didn't film, but we found footage of her in an interview making the same connection. And she coincidentally went to a Rosenwald school herself. Was very proud of it.
Your mission in life, as I understand it, has been to use film to investigate non-stereotypical images of Jews in history and celebrate the untold stories of Jewish heroes. But he was so humble and so almost clandestine in the way he did this. He let his foundation purposefully die after he died. Because he didn't believe, and he wouldn't put his name on things because he didn't think he should. How did you find out about him?
Well, luckily enough, 12 years ago last month, I was on Martha's Vineyard and attended a lecture at the Hebrew Center entitled Blacks and Jews. And at that time, because Julian Bond was speaking, my hero in the Civil Rights Movement, I thought I was hearing a talk about the Civil Rights era. But in fact, Julian Bond's own father and uncle had gotten funding from the Rosenwald Fund, which we'll talk about in a little while, a separate mm-hmm. entity. And sure enough, he started talking about these building of 5,000 schools plus, and also the incredible generosity of the fund he developed that gave grants to people like Marian Anderson and Du Bois and Jacob Lawrence, and I thought, oh my gosh, this has to be my next film. Wow. And I have to say, the most often comment that's given to me is, how did I never know of him? It's just incredible that people have never heard of either the schools, and I'm sure the other guests will talk about it, how it's something that only your only community went. And then people in Chicago know about him because he also was the funder of the Museum of Science and Industry and many other things.
Which he also refused to put his name on. Dan Morrill,
right.
you are an historian, and you seem to know everything about this area over the years that we've talked. You really do know everything about it. How familiar were you with Julius Rosenwald as a person and the schools that he created here in Charlotte?
Well, soon after I became involved in preservation here, which was back in the mid-1970s, I encountered the Rosenwald Schools. And I'm very familiar with, there are two Rosenwald Schools that literally are within a mile's circumference of this studio where we're sitting right now. So I became very aware of them. And one of the things that was so really ingenious about this concept was that the local community had to participate. It wasn't just a matter of Julius Rosenwald giving the money. Mm-hmm. It was a matter of really convincing the local community to come up with resources as well in order to get that money. And one of the reasons that North Carolina was so successful in the Rosenwald School movement was because of George Davis. Now, George Davis was a professor at Johnson C. Smith University, retired, but he became the North Carolina agent for the Rosenwald Fund and literally went all over the state convincing local school boards to raise money to be able to provide local resources for these schools as well. And we have saved his house in cooperation with Johnson C. Smith University. So, I mean, what more is life worth than trying to lift people up? And Rosenwald and Booker T. Washington, mm-hmm. of course, truly are heroes.
Of course, we didn't save all of the Rosenwald schools, and that's one of the things that Betty Edwards Murchison, who's sitting in a studio in Durham, has been working to do around the state. How many schools are there? How many buildings are there that still remain in at least good standing, Betty?
Well, Mike, we are working really hard to answer that question and to find as many schools as possible. It's a very difficult process because the schools were mostly located in rural areas with no street names. This is before we named streets. Hmm. They were called by the community or the church they were associated with. So we are still actively seeking. We have some schools on a study list. The North Carolina Department of Cultural Resources has done a wonderful job utilizing volunteers across the state who are doing it because of their passion for finding out more about these schools. And we currently have right many schools that are on the National Register. One of the ones, one of those is the DuBois High School, which I attended in Wake Forest. Unfortunately, before we could rescue the building, the roof collapsed, and so it's no longer viable. But in Wake County, we still have four other schools that are on the National Register, and the alumni members and community members are working very hard to preserve those.
I have to ask you, because in the film, when you watch the film, a lot of there are a couple of moments in the film where people will be talking about their experiences at these schools, and one of them will say, there was the picture of Abraham Lincoln on the wall, and there was a picture of Booker T. Washington on the wall, and there was a picture of this other white guy that we didn't know who he was on the wall. And we came forward and we would say, well, who is he? Why is he on the wall? And they would say, it's Julius Rosenwald, and he's the man who made this possible for you. Were you aware of who he was when you were a student at Du Bois in the Wake Forest?
No, we did not have those pictures on the wall. My school was built in 1926, and I started school there in 1960. It was only after the building was put on the National Register and we started efforts to preserve it that we discover that the historical significance of that school. And we held the first conference along with the help from the National Trust. We held the first conference in Charlotte in 2001, I believe it was, mm-hmm. and found out there were enthusiastic people in 15 states who were actively trying to acknowledge the contribution made by Mr. Rosenwald and preserve their schools. And that's when the National Trust decided to start the Rosenwald School Initiative.
Mm-hmm. Dan, as you say, we sit within a mile of two of these Rosenwald schools in Charlotte. We only have about 45 seconds left in the segment, but are they still standing? Are they in decent repair?
One of them's in fair condition. The other one is highly dilapidated. And when you have time, the Siloam Rosenwald School, I could tell you a very interesting story about how we tried to build momentum to save that mm-hmm. school, and it's very much in jeopardy.
Okay. We'll come back and talk more about the schools around the state, the schools in Charlotte, what they meant at the time, and more about the man who made them possible, Julius Rosenwald, with three people who know about it intimately, including the filmmaker of a film called Rosenwald, The Remarkable Story of a Jewish Partnership with African-American Communities. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Corkscrew Wine Shop and Bar located in Burkdale Village in Lake Norman, offering wines from around the world, live local music, and craft beer on tap. Relax, uncork, unwind. The Corkscrew. Details at thecorkscrew.com. And Charlotte Mecklenburg Stormwater Services, providing volunteer opportunities for residents to improve neighborhood streams through the Adopt a Stream and Storm Drain Marking programs. Info at stormwater.charmec.org. Well, you know, print media is going through some tough times as the result of the digital age, but that does not mean that people have stopped reading the news. New community news websites are popping up everywhere, and the venerable Charlotte Observer has been trying out several digital products as well. We're going to hear from the operators of a number of these community news websites about how they operate, who reads them, and how they make enough money to stay in business tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Pope Francis arrives in the U.S. this week, his first visit ever. His agenda includes an address to Congress and meetings at the White House and the U.N. how the Pope is changing conversations about the environment, the world's poor, and the future of the Roman Catholic Church.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about a man most of you have probably never heard of, but whose impact was substantial in the early 20th century, and actually whose impact continues to this day for the people who benefited from his generosity. That man is Julius Rosenwald. There's a film about him that opened over the weekend for a two-week run at the Regal Ballantyne Village Stadium Theaters called Rosenwald, The Remarkable Story of a Jewish Partnership with African American Communities. It's the work of Aviva Kempner, who joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. She's the director, writer, producer of that. Betty Edwards Murchison is also with us from Durham, where she is a Rosenwald School alumnus and working to restore these schools, save and restore these schools around the state. And Dan Morrill is with us as well in our studio. He's historian and director of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Historic Landmarks Commission. I want to get back to something that you said, Aviva, early in the conversation, that Julius Rosenwald was inspired by the Jewish ideas of charity and repairing the world. This is an old, it runs through the entire religion to do that. He's probably not the only person who has followed those rules, but he certainly had an impact with what he did.
Yeah, it's just very much a principle, tzedakah, also charity, that part of what we should be doing is making sure that we look around us and try to do something. As a matter of fact, the one thing I'm hoping most about the film is not everyone has $62 million to give away, which is how much he gave away in his lifetime. It was like $1 billion. But that there's like a Julius Rosenwald, as we call him in the film, J.R. in us, and that maybe and hopefully you come out of the film and you're inspired to do something in your own community, mm-hmm. your church, your synagogue, even help this whole movement to restore the schools. There's 100 schools around the country, and I'm hoping even more that are being restored into community centers or museums. And that, you know, it's, we just shouldn't look. There's a woman at the end of the film, Kinsasha Holman Conwell, who actually is a curator at the new upcoming African American Museum, says, you know, if I was here, I would thank him for just not ignoring what was happening around him and doing something. And I really think the film is a call to action in terms of that.
It was a different world when Mr. Rosenwald was growing up, because as we said, he's the son of an immigrant peddler. He apprenticed himself early in his life in the clothing business in New York. He didn't finish high school.
Yeah, that's the irony. He stopped going to school at 16.
Yeah. And yet he went on to run what was at the time the Amazon.com of the United States. I mean, Sears, with their catalog that went to almost every home in America, was an enormous enterprise, the largest retail store in America. How did a person who never finished high school go on to run and own Sears?
Well, he had a great business sense. He had learned that from his own working in his father's store. He went off to New York and apprenticed. He had a real compassion for his workers. He used to say, "I don't work; they don't work for me; they work with me." And Sears was a great salesman. When Julius Rosenwald bought in with his brother-in-law, Nussbaum, he brought efficiency in a way. It was Henry Ford for ordering things, that they would have young men on roller skates taking the order. There'd be like a pneumatic tube to send the order, and he made it much more organized. I mean, the funny thing is that Sears owed Rosenwald money for these summer suits he had developed, so he didn't even have to pay cash. It was like a credit thing that he owed him money, and that's how he could come in and buy it. You know, it's always been true in business, the efficiency. But he wasn't satisfied with just being a businessman. He had said very early in his marriage that he should save a third, live on a third, and give away a third. And that was a principle that he operated on. And I have to say, going back to the schools, first of all, North Carolina had the most than any other state. We've heard 800 plus. And the way it was arranged, that the state would do a third, and there was a very enlightened white administration, but it was also very much, as they said, George E. Davis in North Carolina. Rosenwald would give a third, and the African-American communities would. But in fact, they gave more than a third. Very early in the game, Julius Rosenwald says, well, we have these Sears kid houses. Let that be the schools. And Booker T. Washington said to Rosenwald, no, it's like what we did in Tuskegee. We're going to build the schools. And it was the communities that built it, the black communities. Oftentimes they donated the land. And in fact, they were also paying taxes and raising money.
Yes, yeah, sweat equity was a very important part of this. And you point out in the film that the Tuskegee Institute, the school, the students and the faculty, they taught what they did, and they did what they taught. They built the buildings, and that's why Booker T. Washington didn't want to buy a building out of the Sears catalog, which you could do back then. He wanted the people to build it. Dan, you wanted to chime in.
Well, there's so many things. Betty, let me ask you a question. How do you feel about your experiences when you reflect back on your years at the W.E.B. Du Bois School in Wake Forest? Do you have good memories? Do you have bad memories? Do you have mixed memories? How do you feel about the nature of the education you got there?
Thank you for that question. I'm very proud of the education I received there, even though it was a segregated school and we had used books and the materials weren't as good as they were at the other schools. There was a lot of pride. And the teachers there had the sense of no child is left behind, even before that became a catchphrase. And they were invested in the children because they lived in the communities. And so, you know, no one threw trash on the ground or, you know, neglected to clean up behind themselves in the cafeteria. So it was a really sense of racial pride. And so, therefore, when schools integrated, and I was a part of the first wave that went over to the former all-white school, we were disappointed in some of the things we saw because we'd been trained differently. But there was great pride because many of the people who worked at the school, their ancestors were the ones who raised the money for the school. And I'm glad Aviva pointed that out. The Rosenwald Fund donated $4.3 million, but the black community donated $4.7 million. Mm. And you have to keep in mind, this is during a time when most of the people were farmers or domestic. They didn't have a lot of money, but the education of their children was important.
I'm really fascinated that it actually worked because it was this matching grant thing that yes. We do in public radio.
The one thing that's so interesting about the Rosenwald School, so many of the issues are so incredibly current.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I don't know what the unemployment rate is among young adults in the African-American community, but I know it's high.
Yes.
And I know that one of the ways that is talked about as a means to try to deal with that is education. That is exactly what Booker T. Washington believed. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what Julius Rosenwald was advocating. So these are not old, stodged ideas. And let me pick up on one thing that that Betty said. One of our Rosenwald schools here in Charlotte-Mecklenburg is Billingsville, which is in the Greer Heights community. Mm-hmm. Several years ago, I went to a reunion of that school. And it was an incredible experience. First of all, some of the teachers that taught at that school came. Mm. And the respect, I mean respect, that those alumni showed toward those teachers was overwhelming. I mean, and let me say something about those teachers. Those teachers were totally, completely dedicated to making avenues of opportunity through education open to those communities. And, you know, I think sometimes people might say, well, we shouldn't even think about the Rosenwald schools. Who wants to remember the Rosenwald schools? That was Jim Crow. That was segregation. Well, it's more complicated than that. And there are things about those schools and about those environment of those schools that when you really tap in to those people who went to those schools, there was something very remarkable happening there.
I agree, Dan. And you bring up a really valid point. At the Rosenwald, when the National Trust held the Rosenwald Conference here in Durham in June, and I gave a welcome address, one of the things I encouraged people to do was to have these courageous conversations. If we don't talk about education and race and class and culture, we're doomed to make mistakes. Because I think about the courageous conversation that it took a former slave to have with the CEO of probably one of the largest corporations in the country at that time. The courageous conversation he had to have with him to get him to buy into this model of building these community schools. If he could do that, then what is it we can do now that can improve the fate of this country?
You mentioned Billingsville, which is in Greer Heights, which is a troubled area of Charlotte today. But
very interesting things happening in it.
It's an urban area, but when Billingsville School was built, it was a rural area. And a lot of these schools were built in these rural areas. And I want to get back to this idea of the matching grant, because he did not pay for the building of all the schools. And in fact, the schools were built by people in the community, and a lot of it was paid for by people in the community. How did Aviva, I don't know if you know the answer to this question or not, but how did Julius Rosenwald think that these people from the rural South who were desperately poor were going to be able to raise the money required to meet the matching grant to build these schools?
Well, he had already seen it happen with the Y's. They had come to him and
the YMCA's
built these black Y's. I mean, matching grant was his principle, and I think it really was effective, because what you do is you get a stake in it. And in the different cities, it was maybe smaller. You know, he would give a third, the Y's would give a third, and the African American communities would raise it. Then you feel you own it. And the need was so strong, people responded.
And in the South, a lot of the money also came from white school boards.
Absolutely.
To build these. Why? Why did they feel moved to do that?
George Davis was mentioned. See, when people don't know the history, they don't know the significance. You know, when we put over $400,000 into restoring George Davis's home, matched by Johnson C. Smith University. And then they're going to pay us back over a seven-year period. And that was an enormous commitment of resources here in this community. But it has to do with the enormous contribution that somebody like George Davis made. It has to do with leadership. It has to do with salesmanship. That man untiringly traveled all over this state to talk at a time. Let's face it. I mean, I could go on and on about, in many ways, what racial attitudes were in the 1920s. I mean, this was a very, very, very different era that we're talking about. But for somebody like George Davis, and so much depended on these local state agents to go out and meet the people one-on-one, talk to these. And all of these school boards were all white. There weren't any African-Americans on these school boards, I can tell you that. And to convince them that they had to come up with resources to... And, you know, the thing about if you know Rosenwald's, you know, they were all built according to standard plans, school 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And my wife and I have such a good time when we're traveling across the countryside, because we'll say, look, there's a Rosenwald school.
Because you can tell by
when you know them,
you
know them.
Because it was these schools were built in the Jim Crow South in 1913 to 1932 by a man who ran the largest corporation in America, I'm really curious about whether he was ever concerned about backlash against Sears for having built these schools throughout the rural South for African Americans. Because you point out in the film, Aviva, that some of these schools were built, were burnt down by the Klan and others one, two, three times or more, and then rebuilt. What about backlash against Sears?
There's no evidence of that. Certainly, Governor Talmadge, who was known for his racist views, called out the schools. But in fact, it was so clever to have gotten the local school boards involved that, you know, in a way it was sort of like a local entity. You know, they also participated in it. Now, this is also, the film doesn't address it, the DVD will. It was the time of Leo Frank, the man who owned ran the pencil factory, who was wrongly accused of murdering one of his workers
in Atlanta.
Lynched.
In Atlanta.
And in fact, Rosenwald had been very active in his legal defense and was horrified what happened to him. So one could even argue it was even dangerous for him being involved. But that did not deter him. You know, and it was also very courageous of those African-American communities building the schools. I mean, there's a whole story in Mississippi that they did it real fast and built it very clandestinely. So they wouldn't be hurt. And Valerie Jarrett, who is, the advisor to President Obama in the White House, her great-great-grandfather, Robert Taylor, was the first black graduate from MIT. He designed the schools, the original design, and they were very much, as the head, the former head of the architecture department at Tuskegee, Dr. Dozer says, they were very much green architecture.
Yeah, they're very
open windows.
Very progressive. Lots of light, good ventilation raised on short piers so that the moisture control around the envelope of the building would be a good thing. Very aesthetic and lots of windows.
Right.
That's why you can spot them from the outside.
Absolutely.
And it's really, and that's why the ones that are remaining and that are being rebuilt are working today. And you know, you can do tours all around and certainly about Charlotte. And I'm hoping, because we didn't have a lot of people come this opening weekend, that, you know, for me, coming to North Carolina was real important. I came on Saturday, and maybe people didn't know I was going to be in town. But what's important is to make sure that people come to the movie to see this wonderful story of building the schools and retaining the schools. And the other thing the fund did was support the who's who of arts and letters in the African-American community. Jacob Lawrence painted The Great Migration with a Rosenwald grant. Marian Anderson went to Europe and was discovered under a Rosenwald grant. Augustus Savage got a Rosenwald grant. James Baldwin, the list goes on and on. John Hope Franklin.
Well, let me stop you because the show has to stop at this point because we can't go on and on. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Doré Construction, a commercial construction firm creating grand openings for regional clients for more than 15 years. D-O-E-R-R-E, construction.com. And Queen City Audio, Video, and Appliances, local purveyors of premium appliances since 1952, including KitchenAid. More information about KitchenAid's new look at queencityonline.com. Pope Francis arrives in the U.S. this week. It's his first visit ever. His agenda will include an address to Congress and meetings at the White House and the United Nations. So on the Diane Rehm Show today in 20 minutes, they take a look at how the Pope is changing conversations about the environment, the world's poor, and the future of the Roman Catholic Church. That's coming up at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, Facebook or Twitter will get you to us at WFAE or email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. We're coming right back.
The WFAE Fall Membership Campaign begins October 1st, but you can help shorten the drive with your pledge now. All contributions made before the drive begins will go toward our $400,000 goal. Every $60,000 raised will be used to eliminate one day of the fall membership drive. You'll also be entered to win a GoPro Hero 4. No pledge is necessary to enter. Get started at WFAE.org by selecting the Contribute Now tab. Thanks for providing critical financial support for WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHA. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Julius Rosenwald and the film about him, which is playing in town for a couple of weeks, called Rosenwald, The Remarkable Story of a Jewish Partnership with African-American Communities. It's about the building of the Rosenwald schools throughout the South, from Virginia through Texas, many of them in North Carolina. Aviva Kempner is the director, writer, producer of that film. She joins us by phone. Betty Edwards Murchison is a Rosenwald School alumnus and who is actively involved in finding these schools and preserving these schools around the state. Dan Morrill is director of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Historic Landmarks Commission. Betty, you were a student at the Du Bois School, the W.E.B. Du Bois School in Wake Forest, just at the end of segregated schools. How important at that point in our history were these schools to the African-American community just prior to integration?
Well, I think they were still very important. One of the important aspects of Rosenwald schools we haven't mentioned yet is that Julius Rosenwald realized that in many African-American communities, there were few places for people to meet, to congregate, to have, you know, large meetings. And so the school I went to had a large cafeteria that was a part of the building. And people held meetings there, voter registration drives or whatever types of meetings that we didn't have other institutions that were large enough to hold the community. So it was a gathering place. It was a place that regardless of what community you lived in or what church you went to, or even if you went to a church, you could still come together there. PTA meetings were like high tea. I mean, people dressed up and women wore hats and it was just a really big thing to be elected president of PTA. You wielded a lot of power.
Well, there was something going on, and this film points this out rather strongly. There was something going on in those schools that is missing today, I think, in almost every school, and that is pride.
Yes.
And incredible respect, not just for the teachers, although, Dan, you pointed that out, but the teachers taught the students the importance of respect, respecting each other, and most importantly, respecting themselves.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I think, and it wasn't just in the Rosenwald schools. There were many schools in the African-American community in the days of segregation that were not Rosenwald schools. And you'll find the same phenomenon there. They were oases. They were oases in an otherwise hostile world. Mm. And these schools were loved. They were beloved. And you also had strong interaction with the local community. You know, you had strong parental involvement. I mean, there were aspects of these schools that if we could emulate the feeling, the attitude, the perception, the pride, and bring them into our public schools today, yeah, I think we would definitely benefit
so
from it.
So given this great pride in these schools and the great gift, I guess, that the community felt that they were, Betty, as you travel the state and try to drum up support for saving what of these structures remain, is that attitude still reflected? Is there still an appreciation for these schools and what they meant down through history that helps you in your efforts?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Not so much in the younger generation because they're just finding out about it and coming to understand their own history, but certainly in baby boomers and older. Yes, it was a sense of pride that was something we owned, something we had some control over. And as Dan said, it was like you were in a cocoon in what was sometimes a hostile environment. And I think many of our teachers were first generation college graduates. So they knew they were preparing students to open doors and go through places that they had not been able to go through themselves. And so it was a community based effort. And we see that. I remember the first conference where Peter Askely attended. He's the grandson of Julius Rosenwald. And I think he and his wife were totally overwhelmed by the outpouring of love from the students who had attended Rosenwald schools and came to this conference. And they were a little taken aback by it, I think. It just they had no idea. I don't believe he had any idea of his grandfather's legacy and the fervor with which people talk about their experiences at these schools.
So it would seem to me that since you're talking about people, baby boomers and older, who remember these schools and really understand the important role that they played, it would seem to me there would be some urgency in your efforts to get these places rehabilitated around the state, because the younger generation, as you say, needs to be brought up to speed. So is there an urgency to this?
There definitely is an urgency. My partner, business partner and I, Marshall Harvey, formed the North Carolina Rosenwald Schools Coalition in order to be able to go around the state and help other people reclaim and restore their schools. We help them with adaptive reuses. We can help them with connecting with government and municipal and civic groups that can help move the project forward. We've seen there's a school down in Pantego, North Carolina, that's in very good condition. And alumni are so proud. And, you know, we tried to help them to establish the connections they needed politically and get the support from the community so that everyone can see these schools are resources for everyone.
And Dan, you've been involved in historic preservation for years.
Too many.
So tell me, for people who don't understand, why a wooden building on short piers that have two classrooms, what were at one time two classrooms in them for the most part, why would that be important to save? It's not
their
icons. It's not ornate.
They're icons. They're, you know, when you save a building, part of the reason that you want to save it is because of the stories that it tells. You know, I was telling you about the Siloam Rosenwald School. Let me tell you what would be a wonderful thing to have happen. And I tried, but it was like dealing with the Byzantine Empire. This school could easily be moved to the UNCC campus. If it were moved to the UNCC campus, it would take up very, very little room. That school could be restored. In fact, they've got architecture students over at UNCC. They've got engineering students over at UNCC. That school could be restored.
It could be a great project.
And it would. Mm-hmm. The reason that you would restore it would be to use it for what it was used for originally, and that is to teach. Because the greatest challenge, in my opinion, that we as a society face is, are we going to embrace diversity, or are we going to resist diversity? Are we going to fulfill the dream, or are we going to run away from the dream? Well, these buildings represent everything that's positive, everything that's good, everything that's noble. And you can take people into buildings like this, and you can give them that message and reinforce that message and bring school children to that school and make them aware of what the Rosenwald School was and what it represented. That's why it's important.
Mm-hmm. We asked on social media this morning about this topic, and we've gotten some responses. John in Charlotte says, ruins of a brick school building are on a Rosenwald School Road in Wadesboro. Could that be a Rosenwald school?
I'm convinced it is.
Kathy in Rock Hill writes, I saw the film in Northern Virginia 3 weeks ago, and it is a wonderful film of an amazing story. The Rock Hill School District rehabbed the Carroll School in York County and uses it to teach students about the Depression and segregation. It is a great learning experience. I don't know if you know about that school or not, Dan. Is that a,
I do not.
Okay. Is that a Rosenwald school? Do you know anybody, Betty or Aviva? Do you know?
No.
Okay.
But, you know, it's interesting what you say, what generation is coming. It is true that the baby boomers and older are coming, but I can't tell you how many three, four generations of families are coming, because the film, because we were able to obtain a lot of footage of that period.
I was going to ask you where you got the footage, because some of it is remarkable.
When you see the long, long credits. Well, you know, I was just talking last night at a book talk of a new book about Thurgood Marshall, and Charles Hamilton Houston was his mentor. And he Houston himself, the desegregation lawyer, went down and took some footage. But different people, you have to see the film. What we did was comb all the archives we could to find footage of African Americans in schools. And it was true, they were separate and not equal. But in terms of the spirit of the Rosenwald schools, there was an incredible learning experience, some of which I think should inspire, you know, the rededication of education today, especially in cities and in areas of poverty. There's great lessons to be learned about community involvement and ownership in schools in the film.
David writes, are your guests familiar with the Rosenwald School in Catawba, North Carolina, and can they comment on its history?
I do not. I know where Catawba is, but I'm not familiar with that Rosenwald School. You know, the thing is, these Rosenwald schools, as I say, are according to a standard pattern. They were literally numbered, so they're easily recognizable, and they're all over the state. Mm-hmm. They're all over the state.
Betty, do you know anything about that school?
I don't, but okay. I can tell him where to go to get information.
Okay.
The North Carolina Department of Cultural Resources has a page for Rosenwald Schools. They have a page for the ones that are on the National Register, and then there's another page for schools that are on the study list. These are schools that we're not sure about and we're investigating. And then if he can't find the information he wants there, he can also go to Fisk University. Fisk University has digitized the original records of Rosenwald School, so they have everyone ever built anywhere.
Wow. The list of alumni, and you went through a partial list of people who were helped by the Rosenwald Foundation, Aviva, before the break, but the list of alumni from these schools is equally remarkable. And I'm going to intermingle, I guess, some names here from the Rosenwald Grant recipient list as well, but Maya Angelou, Marian Anderson, U.S. Representative John Lewis, who appears in your film, Washington Post columnist and Pulitzer Prize winner Eugene Robinson, who also appears in the film, George Wolfe, Woody Guthrie, a white guy, got a Rosenthal grant.
Rosenwald.
Ralph Ellison, Langston Hughes, James Baldwin, ancestors of Anita Hill, Attorney General Loretta Lynch, and ancestors of Oprah were also alumni. Talk about the rigor of education given in these schools, the quality, because obviously they were special.
That was one of the things that came across in the in talking with alumni, that, you know, these teachers, they were very much in control. And they were expected to perform. The expectation level was high, because these teachers knew that these children were going to have special skills to be able to survive. I mean, that's true.
Betty?
Yeah, I was just going to agree with what Dan said. It was a very rigorous education. You were expected to memorize poetry and sayings and be able to express those at the drop of a hat. Public speaking was part of it from first grade on up. You were put in front of the assembly, which included grades 1 through 12. They were consolidated schools. And even if you were in first grade, you had to say a poem or had to recite something, had to memorize things. And so that's the reason I think that a lot of people went on to to illustrious careers because they were prepared for it. And I wanted to make another note about education in the South. During the time these were, schools were being built, the average amount spent on Negro children was $12.57, while the average amount being spent on white children was $44.31. So you can see the discrepancy and understand why the schools were not separate and equal.
As we said in the beginning, a lot of people don't know about Julius Rosenwald. He was so unknown. It stems from the fact, in part, that he felt his money should be spent while he was still alive, and he died in the 1930s. He didn't believe in foundations that would last after his death, and he was incredibly humble. He the most successful businessman in America of his generation. But I took the liberty of lifting a piece of audio from your film of Julius Rosenberg, Rosenwald himself, giving the rest of us in the world a word of caution.
Most people are of the opinion that because a man has made a fortune, that his opinions on any subject are valuable. Don't be fooled by believing, because a man is rich, that he is necessarily smart. There is ample proof to the contrary. Most large fortunes are made by men of mediocre ability who tumbled into a lucky opportunity and couldn't help but get rich.
Julius Rosenwald himself, from the film Rosenwald, the remarkable story of a Jewish partnership with African-American communities. It plays at the Regal Ballantyne Village Stadium 5 for the next couple of weeks. Aviva Kempner is the filmmaker. Betty Edwards Murchison, a graduate of the Rosenwald School in Wake Forest and working to restore these schools. And Dan Morrill with the historic Mecklenburg County Landmarks Commission. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. Our producers are Aaron Kiever and David Borax. The engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks archives, upcoming shows, and podcasts, or to continue the conversation online, go to WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
And support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Beckler Museum of Modern Art, presenting the exhibition Sam Francis, Rapid Fuel Indivisible Vision. Rapid Fluid.